You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Derek Frost from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. And we start on the front page with the cover story headline, "He Wants More, Much More." SaaS co-founder James Goodnight is far from done in building the world's largest privately held software company. He is trying to reinvent it again, and that means worker buyouts, reclassification of jobs, and renewed focus on margins. Can he finish the job? And the actual cover story begins inside the Triangle Business Journal with the second headline, "Why Goodnight Remains Obsessed with Innovation." And this article is written by Lauren Anasorge. It's 2018, and founder Jim Goodnight commands the crowd, just as he did the classrooms at NC State University before creating what would become SAS Institute in Cary in 1976. "Artificial intelligence," he booms to the record audience in Denver. "These days, a lot of people are using the term artificial intelligence, or AI, and they're using it in place of analytics, but really, AI is simply a continuation of the advanced analytics we've been working on for years." Fast forward to 2019, and another record crowd is murmuring to a hush in Dallas, but this time it's Oliver Schabenberger, the chief operating officer, and recently named heir to Goodnight's CEO seat, opening the SaaS Global Forum, pacing across the stage and joking he does actually own a pair of jeans. The face is different, but the talking points are eerily the same. That's not an accident. As insiders say, that's one of the things Goodnight is looking for in SaaS's next CEO, common outlook. And part of that has to be what he's banking on being SaaS's next frontier, AI. "Yes, AI is overhyped, but it's also real and powerful," Schabenberger says. "Many technologies and methodologies are today swept under the AI umbrella, and that's okay. Our current form of narrow artificial intelligence is data-driven, and that distinguishes this era of AI from the approaches in the past." As the $3 billion-plus entity SaaS works towards the unthinkable, the replacement someday of the 76-year-old Goodnight, it's also refreshing its strategy. This evolution has major implications for the Triangle. As of last year, SaaS had more than 14,000 employees, including more than 5,500 at its Cary headquarters operation. The rise of SaaS powered Cary's growth and helped establish the region as one of the nation's hubs for technology. And the billions of dollars that flowed into SaaS created comfortable jobs while supporting the arts and the educational system in the Triangle. SaaS has remained an amazing story in the sense that it has managed to remain private despite all the dollars thrown at the company by public markets, says retired Triangle banker Bob Hatley. Coupled with its workplace benefits, it has been a benchmark for many other companies in the Triangle. "What happens to SaaS matters to the entire community," he says. To some extent, market conditions are forcing the Cary company to make fundamental changes to the way it operates, starting from the way it sells products and services to its customers, the pricing model, and finally, emphasizing how it is different from competitors such as IBM, Google, and even Amazon. And then there are startups that often litter the path with mines for the tech giants who are now experiencing the pricing pressure more than ever. Margins can no longer be protected. To be a player in almost any tech verticals, customer acquisition is the name of the game. Companies must have a robust pipeline of new customers. If not, the road to nowhere is just around the corner. Business as usual. Goodnight, through company representatives, has said repeatedly he has no plans to retire. He declined to be interviewed for this story, as did Schabenberger. Heir apparents have come and gone before at SaaS, but Schabenberger is the first that Goodnight has ever confirmed a possible successor publicly. SaaS develops software aimed at making analytics accessible to enterprise businesses. As Goodnight describes it, it's a way for companies to put their own data to use. The applications are already seemingly endless, from credit card companies detecting fraud to medical research firms using terabytes of data to diagnose and treat patients. What is new is the $1 billion recently pledged by SAS for AI, both the innovation and a center of excellence for training its talent. Goodnight is a big believer in investing in the future, Gartner analyst Jim Hare says. AI is not new, it's been around a number of years, but the timing is right. We're starting to see real solutions to make it real for customers. While AI has been part of the strategy for years, it became a headline for SAS last year when the company created a new division aimed at fighting fraud through artificial intelligence and analytics. The plan, said Stu Bradley, leader of the firm's new business, would help differentiate ourselves and allow SAS to deliver more consistently across its customer base. In March, analysts lauded the AI investment news. Tony Baer, a principal research analyst with Ovum, called it a very logical move. It's not like SAS is going to go out of business in 3 years if it doesn't do this, he says. SAS has plenty of long-term relationships with its client base, but it really is a statement of where they want to go. IDC's Ritu Jyoti called the training program SAS announced refreshing. Any investment that goes towards the education and training certification programs to help the analysts, the professionals, that's a great move in my opinion, she says. Shifting model. And that could be why SAS made such a commitment, as Goodnight has been an outspoken advocate of bolstering the Triangle talent pool, both through education initiatives, including by speaking out on pre-kindergarten programs and investing in analytics degree programs at universities such as NC State, and by advocating for H-1Bs, the visa reserved for highly technical jobs. Goodnight has been outspoken on panels and interviews about the difficulty SAS has, even with its wonderland of a campus, which boasts of sushi, exercise classes, and even an on-site hair salon, in hiring top analytics talent. He calls it critical for SAS's future, and the reason it's provided software, free of charge, to 70 different Masters of Analytics programs across the globe. The world is changing, and he sees fresh talent as being critical to innovation, which could be why 200 longtime SAS employees were offered voluntary buyouts last year to make way for new employees in different divisions of business with different skill sets. SAS does not comment publicly on what jobs were eliminated and what were filled, but a few people who have left in recent years have acknowledged the company is changing, and so is the mood. Once an automatic list topper in Best Places to Work rankings, the Kerry Company has taken a big tumble, dropping from number 8 in 2016 in Fortune's list to number 60 this year. Also, some internet workplace review sites are hosting comments from former and current employees far from favorable for the company. To Goodnight, however, the chatter has never fazed his drive to keep SAS relevant, and for now, just like some 40 years ago, Goodnight believes innovation will determine the level of SAS's dominance in the next decade. The company has gone through multiple executive shuffles, the biggest hitting in 2000 when Goodnight created an executive management team, reported at the time to set policy and direction for the company. Goodnight revamped the research operation in 2007, a move that had a new group reporting directly to the CEO when it came to chip technologies. And in 2017, he reconfigured the sales organization, cutting his direct reports in half and giving his newest protege, Schabenberger, more responsibility. Focused on research. Reporting directly to Goodnight can be a daunting task, past employees have said. Compliments are rare and given in short sentences, insiders say. Critiques, however, can mean speeches. Goodnight's standards have always been high, and some former colleagues say that's why his company has endured. Insiders say he knows what he wants and that no can be met with the cold stare of a displeased professor. He sets the goals, and it's up to the management team to execute, no excuses. In 2000, for example, he instructed his management team to write up a business plan to generate $1.5 billion in annual revenues from electronic commerce within 3 years. A bold plan at a time when the industry was just starting to take shape. We are and we will be a major supplier to all e-commerce sites, he said at the time. And it's a challenge his team met by trial and error, a methodology Goodnight appreciates when he sees results. And Goodnight has always been willing to spend money to make sure that it does. In 1998, the company spent about a third of its annual revenue on research and development. In 2018, the R&D breakdown was 26%. Industry-wide, the average is just 12.5%. For context, a 2014 report by Quartz showed Microsoft and Amazon invested just 12% and 10.4% of their revenues into R&D, respectively. The same report put Apple's investment at just 3%. For SaaS, the competition is only growing, making continued innovation a necessity for its survival. When SaaS first entered into the data warehousing space decades ago, it found itself against giants such as Oracle, Platinum Technologies, and Microsoft. And as SaaS doubles down in AI, the competitors might number in the hundreds as startups seem to emerge daily with their eyes on cognitive computing. Gartner's Hare says SaaS is in an enviable position. Its customers aren't just looking for the next big technology. They're looking for stability, which is exactly what SaaS has been delivering. It's something a startup, even one hailed as a unicorn, just can't promise. In January 2018, the company posted $3.2 billion in revenue for 2017. This summer, SaaS released a new 2018-2019 annual report that posted just under $3.3 billion in 2018 revenue. It's not the double-digit increases that make headlines, but it's steady, notes Gardner's Hare. I can't say SaaS is the first to adopt the latest and greatest technology, Hare says, noting market challenges such as the rise of open source are impactful, as is the rise of cloud competitors offering their own analytics solutions. But customers aren't turning to SaaS to rock the boat. Customers look at SaaS and they've been around 40, 50 years, Hare says. No one has ever gotten fired for buying SaaS. It's a really safe choice in terms of buying a product that you know is going to work. Data scientists feel like a kid in a candy shop amid the plethora of options in the market. But when it comes to the business side of the enterprise, they're just looking for solutions. If it can benefit from AI and machine learning, they're interested, but they just want to make sure it works, Hare says. Citizen scientists, the SaaS sweet spot, aren't coders. They're using drag-and-drop tools without having to look at the code behind the scenes, and it's something Goodnight has always recognized, he says. The future. At the 2019 SaaS Global Forum, Schabenberger downplayed existing AI technologies from facial analysis to much of the object manipulation applications used in manufacturing, saying analytics has more staying power than the AI people most often think about. And the crowd was receptive to the talking points, but insiders say Schabenberger's management style is softer than Goodnight's. Soft is not a word that's been used to describe Goodnight's leadership. Goodnight's no-nonsense style has instead been called intimidating, and it's present in day-to-day interactions as well as company-wide memos. Sales need to sell more and R&D needs to produce more, he wrote in a memo in 1998 to his staff. Insiders say Schabenberger found out he was the heir apparent from a Goodnight interview with Bloomberg, not the man himself. But both Goodnight and Schabenberger are described as thoughtful by those who know them, rather than just spouting off. One insider says they're both very deliberate, going over their words internally before speaking them, and then standing by their statements. They have similar backgrounds. Schabenberger, like Goodnight, is a statistician, and they both have high expectations. With Goodnight, those that meet those expectations are rewarded with globally known perks, such as 35-hour work weeks and a community-like campus complete with a pool and sushi options. A year-after-year contender on best places to work lists, Goodnight has long been an advocate for his employees, a fiercely loyal CEO to his followers. And it has resulted in fierce loyalty in return on campus, one that could be hard for any successor to replicate. In the early days of SaaS, Goodnight was known for handing out M&Ms to employees on Wednesdays and chatting up low-level colleagues on the elevator about geodes. And in response for his commitment to a workplace utopia, SaaS boasts one of the lowest turnover rates in the industry, estimated by some to be lower than 4%. Even though rankings have slipped in recent years, the company still rates 3.7 stars out of 5 on Glassdoor.com. Former Chief Marketing Officer Jim Davis says the key is that culture. 6 months into his job, his mother became ill. In addition to approving time off, SaaS sent volunteers to his mother's house to build a wheelchair ramp. There are a lot of stories like that, he says. Jim really worked hard to try to maintain it. It's really hard to maintain this culture of inclusiveness. It's a utopia Goodnight wants to keep in place, and insiders have said that's one reason he's been so careful in talking about secession. He doesn't want to name an heir until he's sure their outlook, not just their skill set, align with what he's envisioning. And Davis says Schabenberger has what it takes, as opposed to bringing someone in from the outside who is a professional executive who doesn't understand and appreciate what the company is all about. It would be very hard for a senior person to come over from the outside and maintain the quality of the company, Davis says. Gartner analyst Ayer says that that's exactly what SAS needs to stay competitive, fresh blood from the outside. Hare says that while Schabenberger may be the next CEO, SAS is aware of its need for outside perspective and has been quietly adding outside talent to its bench. Not for sale. Goodnight has fiercely rejected exit possibilities, saying in multiple interviews that the firm he founded is not for sale. The word is out there we aren't interested in being acquired, Goodnight told Bloomberg in 2009. That's as in 2007, he reportedly flatly refused two offers from an unidentified firm to buy SAS. Insiders say there have been multiple offers throughout the years, followed handily by multiple rejections. And they think Goodnight wants the same attitude from a successor. Goodnight has considered taking his company public, confirming discussions with both Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs as early as 1998 in staff memos, but a public offering never materialized. Instead, Goodnight has continued to hold tight control over the company. Maintaining its private status has allowed SAS to take on the long-term view and avoid stock-driven analyst downgrade peers such as IBM have faced in recent quarters as they, like SAS, seek to transform in a changing industry. But a public offering could have assisted Goodnight in estate planning. Public stock can ensure liquidity, helping a company like SAS survive its founders. The topic of his secession comes up frequently in interviews and panel appearances and has been rebuffed each time. The minute I don't think I'm being effective as a leader, I will replace myself, he said a decade ago to Bloomberg. Goodnight continues to push the vision. Insiders say he's an extremely active CEO and is determined not to let SAS rest on the status quo while constantly touting opportunities ahead. In 2018, he told the forum crowd the biggest opportunity is nearing SAS's reach. Think about what will be possible with nearly every object when nearly every object has its own IP address, he said. When our models keep getting smarter, when every organization is working analytics, the old constraints are falling away left and right, and we are speeding toward a bigger and bolder future. Now we turn to Biz, a quick glance at Triangle Happenings, written by managing editor Dane Huffman. New Chapel Hill bookstore banks on chocolate, coffee. When the bookshop closed in Chapel Hill in 2017, it had what many businesses on Franklin Street have lacked: frequent foot traffic, plenty of space, and a unique identity among a collection of chain eateries and swanky restaurants. Now, it's just another empty storefront on the busy downtown street. Book selling just wasn't a lucrative business, the manager said then, especially with Franklin Street rents. 2 years later, Jamie and Miranda Sanchez are betting against that. The couple will open Epilogue Books Chocolate Brews at 109 East Franklin Street next month. The shop will sell books, local beer, and coffee and pastries made on site. Jamie Sanchez said there was a void after the bookshop closed and says, "We know how positive of an impact a bookstore has on a downtown. They are aware of the high turnover of businesses on Franklin Street. It is definitely a constant thought of ours, knowing that what the challenges are for the main drag in terms of economics for a small business," Jamie Sanchez says. "But we did our homework for both sides of the business, cafe and bookstore. A bookshop with rent prices what they are couldn't survive on the downtown strip by itself," Miranda Sanchez adds. "It just couldn't. That's why we bought in the cafe piece from a finance perspective." The couple hopes to attract local residents as well as students and will have extended hours during exams. Epilogue will be a unique spot in this regard, says Matt Gladick, executive director of the Chapel Hill Downtown Partnership. "One of the things that downtown Chapel Hill is lacking completely at the moment is a clean, well-lit place to enjoy a book or a short story at night past 8 o'clock, he says. "Everything is very much alcohol-focused. The cafe element is inspired by their travels through Spain, Mexico, and other chocolate-friendly cultures. With that, the Sanchez's believe their bookstore can thrive even in the digital age. It's more about the experience in that you can find books that wouldn't come up in your algorithm on Amazon, Miranda says. Man who leads the charge for Wake County lauded. Biz offers a hearty congrats to Michael Haley, Executive Director of Wake County Economic Development, who was named the 2019 Economic Developer of the Year by the North Carolina Economic Development Association. Haley received the award at NCEDA's annual meeting last month. The awards program recognizes members who distinguish themselves in growing jobs, recruiting new companies, and attracting economic investment, according to the NCEDA's website. Wake County has seen over 3,000 new jobs created in the past year. The county also convinced Advanced Auto Parts to move its headquarters to Raleigh in November and landed a new Amazon distribution center in Garner. Report shows how quickly Raleigh is being gentrified. Raleigh's rapid gentrification is no surprise to those who've seen the changes in downtown neighborhoods, but the scope of the change is made clear in a new report from the Federal Reserve Bank of Philadelphia, which measures gentrification by market. The report ranks Washington, D.C. as tops in the country for percent gentrifying at 43.7%. Raleigh is number 9 at 21.3%. The analysis looked at the rise of gentrification, with college-educated people with high income seeking to live in urban areas, and the reactions to that. The report says the trend has generated far more alarm than excitement, noting concerns about the traditional residents being priced out. But the report finds the trend creates some important benefits for original resident adults and children and few observable harms, it states. It notes that gentrification reduces the exposure to poverty and results in rising home values. And for children, the report says the change increases their exposure to neighborhood education and employment levels. Need a new job? Here's your chance at Raleigh Job Fair. Job seekers, prep your resumes. August 1 marks the 9th rendition of the WRAL Capital Area Career Expo, and 5,000 vacancies are at stake. Happening at the NC State University McKimmon Center from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., the free event is a way to get your resume in front of more than 80 employers, from Credit Suisse to UNC Healthcare, organizers say. Pat Sturdivant, Executive Director of Capital Area Workforce Development, notes that employers in industries such as construction and healthcare are finding it difficult to fill vacancies. Triangle still lags when it comes to convention business. Raleigh leaders are always looking for ways to boost visitation and maximize use of the Raleigh Convention Center, and a new report underscores the issue. Cvent's annual 2019 ranking of the top meeting and convention destinations in the United States does not list the Triangle among the top 50 destinations. Cvent is a meetings, events, and hospitality technology provider with more than 300,000 users worldwide. Per the Cvent data, released July 16, Orlando, Florida remains the top spot for convention business, followed by Las Vegas, Nevada. Chicago and Atlanta are third and fourth. Charlotte ranks number 28. The Queen City boasts of having 166 meeting hotels with 27,197 rooms. The 2019 rankings are based on meeting and event booking activity across Cvent's venue sourcing sites, including the Cvent Supplier Network, through which more than $16 billion in business was sourced in 2018. By the way, number 49 was Detroit, and number 50 was Cleveland. Pappas Capital adds to the ranks of its executive team. Pappas Capital is bringing on fresh executives, but the founders say the original crew remains actively involved. The firm, a leading investor in early-stage life sciences companies and founded by managing partner Art Pappas, is promoting Kyle Rosbach to managing partner. Also, Matthew Boyer is succeeding longtime chief financial officer Ford Worthy. Pappas will remain a managing partner, splitting some duties with Rosbach, and Worthy will continue on as a partner and advisor. Pappas says the additions effectively position us to continue executing on our mission of investing in companies creating the next generation of life sciences products and technologies. And now we turn to the On Technology and Transportation page written by Lauren Onosorge. SharpView spins off seeks middle market deals. A pair of investment veterans are eyeing deals across the nation, armed with a new fund they say could boost Raleigh's reputation in institutional capital. Former State Budget Director Lee Roberts and partner Doug Vaughn, previously the Senior Managing Director and Chief Administrative Officer at Triangle Capital Corp, are spinning off SharpView Capital. In addition to its more well-known real estate investment track, that includes an opportunity fund aimed squarely at middle market companies. We think there are still a lot of gems out there, Vaughn says. SharpView was previously an arm of Curry, which still serves as strategic partner with and investor, having fronted about $100 million towards the new entity. We have closed on about $160 million across our strategies, Robert says. We have targeted raising approximately another $100 million away from the insurance company. The SharpView Opportunity Fund, a lower middle market vehicle that is already two deals in, has Vaughn excited about the opportunities ahead. We're trying to create a platform, an alternative investment platform, that gets Raleigh to where it should be, he says, noting it could keep investment professionals in Raleigh after graduating from area universities. The opportunity is high, SharpView believes. Deal flow begets deal flow, Robert says. Once you start doing a few deals, people start to know that you're there. Investment fund seeks $100 million. A four-year-old investment firm in Raleigh is raising $100 million to fund what its top executive hopes will be the next great restaurant brands. So far, securities filings show nearly $30 million of that target has been closed, and it's all earmarked for restaurant concepts, says Jeff Brock, founder of Hargett Hunter. This was the first closing of a committed vehicle where we hope to replicate the strategy 8 to 10 times and build a diversified portfolio, he says. So far, it's three investments in Original Chop Shop, Bella Green, and Stacked have been deal by deal. Going deal by deal has a lot of advantages, Brock says, but it also has a lot of disadvantages. You can't move nearly as quickly as you would like. An investment in a fourth concept could close this summer. He hopes to one day bring the concepts to North Carolina. It's so much more difficult than the average consumer would think just to plop a store up, Brock says. To do it right, you really need to build a team. You really do need to build a platform. Opening in a new market is a very thought-provoking exercise. So for us, I think that Raleigh and Charlotte and all the Carolinas would be fantastic for all our brands, and I'm hoping that can come together in the next 12 to 24 months. New pods could change travel with ultra-rapid transit. Could Hyperloop mean opportunity for North Carolina? Yes, says Ryan Kelly, head of marketing and communications for Virgin Hyperloop One. Kelly talked up the technology, which can transport you from Raleigh to Washington, D.C. in about a half hour, to an executive-heavy crowd July 12 at the Regional Transportation Alliance's 2019 Transportation Breakfast. When hours become minutes, everything changes, where you can live, where you can work, he says. The company just announced that North Carolina would be the 9th state to explore the possibility of a Virgin Hyperloop One system. Kelly calls Hyperloop a simple automated technology with 28-person pods shooting through tubes within seconds of each other at 671 miles per hour. The pod itself actually propels and levitates off of the track, so you'd actually be floating. You'd be going at airline speeds floating using our levitation system, but we control the weather inside the tube, so there's no turbulence, he says. Scott Levitan, CEO of the Research Triangle Foundation, calls it a tremendous opportunity, pointing out that cities looking at Hyperloop, from Austin, Texas to Kansas City, are places that have won economic development projects over North Carolina. We need the business community to see this same presentation and really look at this seriously, he says. We really need to get behind this and at least evaluate how we connect to the region. Michael Landguth, CEO of the Raleigh-Durham Airport Authority, calls it a cool technology and says he's not worried about its potential to disrupt short-haul flights. You need to think about our long-term vision for RDU, he says. Our long-term vision is to connect RDU worldwide. And now we turn to the page written by Seth Thomas Gulledge on healthcare and education. Meredith unveils new initiative for scholarships. In an effort to increase affordability and highlight financial opportunities for students, Meredith College has announced $20,000 merit scholarships to incoming freshmen, provided they meet a certain academic standard. The scholarships will begin with the fall 2020 class, awarded to freshmen with an unweighted grade point average of 3.3 and a score of at least 1,100 on the SAT or 22 on the ACT. The scholarship is renewable for up to 4 years to students with good academic standing, theoretically allowing students to shave $80,000 off their total tuition. According to Meredith officials, annual tuition for this year is $38,620. Provost Matthew Polusny says a large portion of incoming students will qualify. We really wanted to set a criteria that would have the widest impact as possible, he says. We wanted something that if somebody gets that score and knows what her GPA is, she knows right away what kind of scholarship she can get. Part of retaining a minimum is to ensure the college can afford the program. The variables we were looking at were the number of students this would impact and how much this was going to put us at risk, he says. We needed to have an area of widest impact, but the risk to us was not going to be that great and was one we knew we will be able to ultimately afford. Polusny notes Meredith awards a large amount of other scholarships, more than $26 million annually. There's a myth among some folks who think Meredith is not an affordable option, he says. It really is when you look at all the scholarships, and we're just trying to demystify the financial aid process and what's available. Morrisville's Circassia expands reach with new purchasing contract. Topping off 2 years of aggressive growth to commercialize its respiratory platform, a Morrisville firm just landed a deal with another major U.S. supplier. Circassia, a British pharmaceutical company that calls the Triangle home to its headquarters, its U.S. headquarters, has announced another deal for its asthma products. Premier, a network of about 4,000 hospitals and 165,000 providers in the country, has signed a group purchasing contract with Circassia, offering its members access to Circassia's NIOX platform, spelled N-I-O-X. Financial details of the deal were not disclosed. The deal follows a similar one last year with the other largest group purchaser in the U.S., Vizient. Suzanne Monahan, Circassia's vice president of its NIOX business unit, says the two contracts have massively expanded the company's reach. This is about access. It's always about the patient access, she says. But it's also about our responsibility as the market leader to provide that access and continually work on that. That access comes with huge potential for revenue. Premier and Vizient represent a $160 billion purchasing volume in the U.S. and represent more than 95% of academic medical centers and over half of the acute care providers in the country. Monahan estimates that in the last 2 years, the company has managed to increase its accessibility by more than 35%, growing from just individual providers to hospital networks. Its product is now available to about 80% of insured patients in the U.S. Circassia's NIOX technology provides a measurement of fractional exhaled nitric oxide, FENO, which is generally found in higher levels in patients with allergic airway inflammation, the major underlying characteristic of asthma. Triangle drug maker first to ship vaccines this season. Coming off rapid expansion in Holly Springs, a drug maker has earned bragging rights as the first to manufacture influenza vaccines this year. Sequirus, spelled S-E-Q-I-R-U-S, the result of a $275 million sell-off of Novartis's influenza vaccine business to CSL in 2014, is the first company in the U.S. to ship off influenza vaccines for the 2019 to 2020 season. The New Jersey company maintains a massive facility in Holly Springs it uses to produce its vaccines. The shipment is just the first of more than 50 million doses the company is planning to manufacture this year. Brent McGregor, Senior Vice President of Commercial Operations, says being into the market first indicates that preparations for the market have gone well, have been well managed, and that our supply chain is functioning in an optimal way. BCBSNC adding jobs to handle Medicaid transformation. Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina is hiring more than 350 employees in two new offices to launch its Medicaid plan as part of the state's Medicaid transformation. The insurance giant made the announcement July 15 that it will be launching two new offices, one in Cary, Weston Development, and one in Winston-Salem, to support its new Healthy Blue Medicaid plan. In Cary, the firm has leased 46,000 square feet and plans to hire about 200 clinical staff, such as case managers, provider network associates, and others with nursing or clinical backgrounds, plus some operations staff. Hiring is expected to continue through the end of the year. These new additions to the Healthy Blue team will be on the front lines of serving our customers, stated Jesse Thomas, CEO of Healthy Blue and vice president of the Medicaid segment. And finally, we have a section on student debt, breaking down Triangle students and college debt. College debt is often an issue for students at Triangle universities. 5.1%. The number of student loans at Triangle area universities went into default during the 2015 to 2018 period. 16,688. The number of student loans during that period that entered the repayment period. Of those, 857 students have defaulted. 0.6%. Duke University's default rate in the 2015 to 2018 period, the lowest in the triangle. And 23.5%, Shaw University's default rate during that period, which saw 141 of its 598 students repaying their loans, enter default. Now we turn to the On Real Estate page, written by Caleb Harshberger. RTP Office Park acquired for nearly $82 million. Research Commons in Research Triangle Park has a new owner after a London and Los Angeles-based investment firm bought the five-building office park with additional room to develop. Global Mutual purchased Research Commons from Greenfield Partners of Connecticut earlier this month, paying more than $81 million for the property. Situated on T.W. Alexander Drive, the nearly 59-acre property features 429,758 square feet of office space across five buildings, all with easy access to RTP, Durham, and Raleigh. The buildings were built between 1985 and 1999. Research Commons also contains more than 18 acres of land, which could accommodate up to 270,000 square feet of additional space. Global Mutual and JLL have not released the exact price of the sale, though Scott Humphrey, managing director at JLL, says it was between $81 million and $82 million. Research Commons features an ideal blend of stability and upside, a combination that is difficult to find in today's market, Humphrey says. This attractive profile, coupled with the heightened level of institutional interest the Raleigh-Durham market is receiving, both from domestic and foreign institutions, resulted in a highly competitive process, he says. The property is leased to 16 tenants with nearly 96% occupancy rate. Global Mutual did not immediately return requests for comment. JLL Capital Markets represented the seller. Greenfield Partners bought the property for $58.7 million from Highwoods Properties in 2014. Investor grosses $9 million in profits from Durham Apartments. Less than 3 years after buying Springfield Apartments, McCann Realty Partners of Richmond, Virginia has sold some Durham apartments for a $9 million profit. Purchased in late 2016 for $24.35 million, McCann sold the property at 4600 University Drive to Gamma Real Estate of New York for $33.25 million. Situated on more than 32 acres near the Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina offices, the 288-unit complex was built in 1986 as two- and three-story garden-style apartments. The latest assessed value of the cluster of buildings and land is $23.2 million. Springfield has four one-bedroom floor plans that range in price from $800 to $1,060, ranging in size from 500 square feet to 800 square feet. Springfield has two two-bedroom floor plans that range in price from $1,095 to $1,199, ranging in size from 904 square feet to 1,010 square feet. Springfield is now managed by Kane Residential. Gamma was founded in the mid-1970s by Richard Calicow, who, along with Jonathan Calicow, still owns the business. Gamma is based in the 101 Park Avenue building in New York City. New tenants announced for University Hill Project. Three new tenants have signed on to University Hill, the $40 million mixed-use development headed for University Drive in Durham. The new tenants include O2 Fitness, My Yoga, and a new yet-to-be-named chicken restaurant created by Ashley Christensen in partnership with MDO Holdings. Christensen is a Raleigh chef and recent winner of the James Beard Award. O2 is expected to open later this year, and My Yoga and the restaurant are slated to open in 2020. The restaurant location will be one of three that MDO and Christensen plan to open in the Triangle next year. University Hill features 300,000 square feet of retail and residential space, including 65,000 square feet of Class A retail and 269 luxury apartments located off University Drive. Developer Hawthorne Retail Partners began construction on the 15-acre site last year with plans to open in the fall or winter of 2019. New grocery store headed to former Kroger site. A new grocery store is headed to North Raleigh with plans to open in the spring of next year. German grocery giant Aldi has plans for a new location in the Triangle at the Linwood Collection Shopping Center, the site of a former Kroger. We are excited to confirm that we are pursuing building approvals for a new Aldi store at 6300 Creedmoor Road with a planned opening in spring 2020, says Krista Surley, a Salisbury division vice president for Aldi, in an email. She said all Aldi locations feature similar layouts and typically include around 1,200 square feet of retail space. Aldi picked the spot on Creedmoor Road for its high traffic volume. We want the best sites that are closest to our shoppers and can support a high daily traffic volume, Surley says. As the demand for Aldi grows, so do our real estate options, she says. And finally, a New York firm grabs hotel in Durham for $15 million. The 21st largest hotel in the Triangle has been sold. A large New York-based real estate private equity firm has purchased the Hilton Garden Inn on Miami Boulevard in Durham for $15.1 million. The Blackstone Group, which has $140 billion of real estate assets under management, recently bought the 177-room hotel from RLJ Companies of Bethesda, Maryland. Earlier this year, Blackstone purchased the nearby Adara Alexander Place apartment complex just north of the Raleigh-Durham International Airport for more than $41 million. RLJ had owned the Hilton Garden Inn since 2011 when the company bought the Wyndham Hotel for $6.7 million and converted it to a Hilton Garden Inn, the mid-priced brand of hotels owned by Hilton worldwide. And now in the Triangle Business Journal, we turn to On Restaurants and Retail, written by Dathan Kazak. Cajun franchise spreads into Raleigh. The classic episode of the 1980 sitcom Seinfeld, where Jerry has to decide between his girlfriend and soup and selects the soup, is exactly how Rob Dyer describes how he first learned about the Louisiana-based restaurant, The Lost Cajun. I had a former employee move out to Colorado, and he told me about this amazing Cajun place out there, Dyer recalls. You remember the soup Nazi? This guy is like the Cajun Nazi. He gets up and makes a little bit of gumbo every day, and when he runs out, he runs out. There's a line down the street. Back then, Dyer was a franchisee with a Chick-fil-A in New Jersey. He moved to North Carolina in 2006 and became a Chick-fil-A owner here. But 2 years ago, a friend opened a Cajun restaurant in Greenville, South Carolina, and invited him to visit. I just came back from New Orleans and didn't need Cajun food again, but I respect him and went down there. Everything on the menu was amazing, Dyer says. A visit to the Lost Cajun's owner, Raymond Griffith, sealed the deal. Griffin grew up in Louisiana but relocated to Colorado and opened a restaurant there. Dyer opened his first Lost Cajun on Christmas Eve of 2018 in the Wakefield Shopping Center. Spending more than $100,000 in renovations, he opened the store with the help of 20 employees. He opened his second location July 8 at the corner of Strickland and Falls of Neuse Roads in Raleigh. There's a different ambiance and feel to both of the locations, he says. The new location has a New Orleans bistro feel to it. Both locations serve up a plethora of Cajun classics such as lagniappe, seafood gumbo, jambalaya, fried oysters, as well as its popular po' boys. Our bread is sourced just for our two locations. We realized a po' boy just isn't a po' boy with a French baguette, says Dyer. We have guests come in and say it's spot on to home. Besides the sourced bread, Dyer also says items such as alligator is flown in from Alabama, and crawfish are flown in live for crawfish boils. There are not a lot of places that care about you as a person. That's that competitive advantage I learned at Chick-fil-A, and that's a motto we're using here at the Lost Cajun. And in a section called Tar Heel Favorite, exhibit explores history of North Carolina barbecue. The City of Raleigh Museum's exhibit, The Story of Barbecue in North Carolina, runs through September 29. Museum Director Ernest Dollar addresses the purpose of the exhibit. Is throwing meat on the grill considered barbecue? The process of barbecuing is a much longer and involved process than simply firing up the grill. It requires the proper temperature and a long cook time. Traditional pig cooking could take up to 24 hours to achieve perfection. Even the two styles in North Carolina are cooked differently. Western usually uses only the pork shoulder and is cooked by convection. What's the source of the term barbecue? We trace the birth of barbecue to native tribes in the Caribbean and those in North Carolina. The process was adopted and spread by both Spanish explorers in the 1500s and European pirates as a way to prepare various meats. The term buccaneers was taken from the barbecue grill called boucans. Barbecuing pork didn't arrive until the 20th century. Why was that? Originally, any meat could be barbecued, but it wasn't until the 20th century that pigs became the barbecue staple. They were a practical choice. Pigs were allowed to forage unrestricted in woods and pastures, allowing them to fatten up with little work on the part of the owners. Usually, they were butchered in the early fall, coinciding with the end of the tobacco harvest. What's something visitors might not have known if they didn't visit the exhibit? Visitors will be surprised to learn just how old barbecue is, some five centuries, and the wide cultural influences of the beloved food they enjoy every day. And in a section called She Said It, the quote, I like the idea of being a part of something with a very established partner such as Michael Olander Jr. and being able to take a special part of one of the things we do at a place like Beasley's and give it a bit of a new style. That's a quote from Ashley Christensen on teaming up with MDO Holdings for three upcoming fast casual chicken restaurants in Durham, Cary, and Raleigh. And finally, Louisiana Brewery plans to open a Raleigh location. An out-of-state brewery and restaurant has set its eyes on the Triangle. Tin Roof Brewing Company of Baton Rouge, Louisiana, has begun construction of its location at Raleigh's 5401 North project being developed by Commercial Properties Realty Trust. We are thrilled to be entering the distinguished craft beer market of Raleigh, where we know people have an appreciation for craft beer, says Tin Roof co-owner William McGeehee. The brewery will be part of a Wake Technical Community College's craft brewing program, where students hone their skills at commercial breweries. Anthony Kaysen, Vice President of Workforce Continuing Education at Wake Tech, says that after the college learned the 5401 North development would include a brewery, the college and the development struck a partnership. Over the past 2 years, we've had 12 craft brewing classes, and we have a field trip session where students go out to the local breweries, Kaysen says. With Tin Roof at 5401, it's just a lot closer for the students. Tin Roof's Michael Till will also teach one of the Wake Tech classes. 5401 North is expected to be completed by first quarter 2020 and is slated to have over 400 acres of commercial, office, and residential living. And in the general news section in the Triangle Business Journal, we have an article by Lauren Onosorge. Red Hat CEO could be positioned to lead IBM. With IBM's $34 billion buyout, Raleigh-based Red Hat CEO Jim Whitehurst is in an enviable position, officially on the senior management team at Big Blue. But some say that position could get even loftier if he is in line for the CEO seat when Ginni Rometty retires. While neither IBM nor Red Hat have publicly commented on that possibility, the mechanics of that move would work, theorizes CloudB CEO Sasha Liborny, who prior to spinning off on his own spent years at Red Hat running JBoss under Whitehurst. Jim is somebody who is extremely smart, who has a lot of potential, he says. For it to happen, Red Hat has to really thrive under its big blue banner, he says. That will be a challenge, as the big question is how independently Red Hat will operate under IBM's umbrella. Whitehurst, who declined to be interviewed, has surprised doubters before. Airline guy turned tech CEO. When Whitehurst took over the CEO role from Matthew Suslick in 2007, some questioned the strategy of putting an airline executive, even one who claimed to write computer programs to sort aviation data for fun in his spare time, in charge of a rising technology company. With Delta Airlines, Whitehurst was in the trenches as the airline underwent a Chapter 11 reorganization. He and the management team scrambled to emerge from the reorganization in a little more than 19 months, a feat that would not have been possible without the vision and the flawless execution of our plan by our outstanding management team led by Ed Bastian and Jim Whitehurst, then Delta CEO Gerald Grinstein stated. As Liborny points out, running Delta adds big points to Whitehurst's resume, as it, like IBM, is a global organization, was weighing a huge transformation. At one point, Whitehurst was thought to be a contender for the CEO slot at Delta, but a course change on the company's board made it obvious he'd need to look elsewhere to get that coveted title. Looking at it now, it's the greatest thing that ever happened to me, he would say of that rejection in a 2011 interview. With Red Hat, it was a different story, one about growth and not turnaround, but board expectations were high. We are confident that he will bring a combination of strategic insight and operational excellence. His experience with large global companies will be essential as Red Hat continues to scale to $1 billion in revenue and beyond, Director William Kaiser said at the time of Whitehurst's hire at what was then a $500 million revenue Red Hat. As of its last fiscal year, that annual revenue had swelled to $3.4 billion. Cloud visions and culture. Early on, Whitehurst was envisioning a cloud future, calling it a massive opportunity in a 2010 interview. 8 years later, that opportunity would be among the reasons cited by Romney for IBM's $34 billion buyout offer. The market is coming to us, Whitehurst said in 2011. At the same time, he led the company to broaden its overall product offerings from middleware to virtualization, hedging its bets in open source. Liborny says IBM's best bet might be keeping Whitehurst where he is, if only in the short term to leverage its credibility in open source as the company completes its cloud transformation. My hope is that IBM is going to shield Red Hat so they can go through that transformation, transform their portfolio, he says. In that time frame, they might need to do things that will not make them grow at the same pace, but will be good for Red Hat in the long run. Now we turn to the Viewpoint page in the Triangle Business Journal to read the guest opinion written by Gary Green, who is the CEO of Green Resources, a recruiting firm in Raleigh. The headline, Effort Paves Way for Competitive Workforce. I was pleased to learn that Governor Roy Cooper recently signed into law a statewide education attainment goal of 2 million high-quality post-secondary degrees and credentials by 2030. This ambitious goal was based on research conducted by the My Future NC Commission that identified a looming workforce crisis in our state. While national news reports highlight North Carolina's explosive growth in diversity, size, and economic activity, forecasts suggest that our state is facing a widening skills gap that puts our people and our state at risk. By 2020, 67% of new jobs across the state will require a post-secondary degree or high-quality credential, but only 49% of North Carolinians between the ages of 25 and 44 have completed that level of education. North Carolina has long paved the way in the world of education. We are known for our first-rate universities and community colleges and some of the best and brightest minds in the country, minds that are directly shaping the future by solving some of the world's toughest problems. Now that the state has set an attainment goal, North Carolina stands the chance to show new leadership in education innovation. and the hard work has already begun. Recognizing that no one system or educational institution can solve our skills gap crisis alone, the My Future NC Commission brought together thought leaders from the education, business, philanthropy, faith-based, and nonprofit communities, and the early results are promising. Through this collaborative effort, the My Future NC Commission has published a call to action, which outlines the attainment goal and a clear path to success. I commend My Future NC and our state leaders for this momentous statewide collaboration, which marks a critical step toward ensuring a prosperous future for North Carolina. It should also be noted that this attainment goal shares the unanimous support of every pillar of the state's education system: the North Carolina Independent Colleges and Universities, the State Board of Education, Cooper's Education Cabinet, the UNC System Board of Governors, and the North Carolina Community College System have all recently passed resolutions of support. North Carolina CEOs have stated that their number one concern is the availability of skilled talent. Setting this statewide attainment goal is an important step toward ensuring that more North Carolinians are prepared for the careers of tomorrow, and that a career-ready workforce is available for North Carolina businesses. And with our remaining time, we'll read as much as we can of the executive voice that focuses on Johnson Akinleye. Position, Chancellor, North Carolina Central University. Family, wife, Juanita. Children, Amonuki and Peter. First job, a lot of odd jobs as a college student that taught me a lot of life lessons. You have to do what you have to do to put yourself through college. When I go to restaurants or coffee shops and see students working, I know they must to sustain themselves, but there's hope that they can hang in there and finish college with a better opportunity. Forging New Directions for NCCU by Seth Thomas Gulledge. The Triangle is no stranger to quality higher education, but it can be difficult to stand out in the Triangle with its world-class universities and robust community college system. And actually, we'll have to stop there as the article goes on to discuss the tens of million dollars in building projects that will be happening at the school. You have been listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Derek Frost, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time, and if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138.